by thanking Lucien for inviting me. It's my first time at PI, so it's quite exciting for me. I'm a PhD student originally from the UK, and I'm in South Carolina right now completing my PhD under the supervision of an ex-faculty member here. So I'm going to be speaking today about this idea of relic quantum non-equilibrium. And I'm going to have to go through and describe what that is first. So the first part of my talk will be a brief introduction to de Broglie-Bohm theory. It's an alternative formulation of quantum mechanics, and until recently was thought to be equivalent, but we now believe that it is not and could be experimentally distinguishable. That's the prime focus of the talk. Then I'll go on to explaining, I guess, how we would model how this non-equilibrium would manifest itself in experiment, and we'll just draw some brief conclusions after that. So, nice simple setup for the talk here. So, this idea of de Broglie-Bohm, and there's a few different ways I could introduce this. There isn't just one derivation. So I'm going to introduce it by a reinterpretation of quantum probabilities. So instead of these intrinsic quantum probabilities, let's try and see where we get if we interpret them actually as just standard probabilities due to ignorance, standard statistical ensemble probabilities. So we can do this because the way the Born distribution, mod psi squared, is conserved, but it's not just globally conserved, it's locally conserved. You know, there's two types of conservation laws. There's laws where something disappears at one point in space and appears immediately in another point, or the local conservation laws that satisfy continuity equations. The idea is that because mod psi squared satisfies a continuity equation, then we can model, we can imitate mod psi squared through the standard way you would do it in fluid dynamics. So the quantum systems have a particular position or configuration. Generally, you would introduce this as the position of a standard non-relativistic quantum mechanical particle, but there are generalizations to field theory. If one does that, then with standard Hamiltonians, we can find this velocity field as the gradient of the complex phase of the wave function. And it's really quite simple. Now, what we've done there is, by construction, mimic mod psi squared, mimic the Born distribution, quantum probabilities. So why mod psi squared? Well, brief step back and let's discuss classical probabilities. Now, in classical mechanics, we have Liouville's theorem and both rho, which we can interpret here as a probability density, and the omega, which is not an integration measure, but a volume in phase space. Now, they're conserved along trajectories. So I've got a little animation here in phase space for you. So imagine this black region here is the extent of our ignorance. We know that the system is somewhere inside that black region, and we can think of this as a kind of density plot. The darker this is, the more sure we are. The lighter this is, the less sure we are about the position, and we can just evolve it in time. So as you can see, the region is not getting any lighter. It stays just as dark. This is showing you that rho is constant. Equally, the volume of that square of our ignorance has not changed. So that if we look at the entropy, the integrand there is zero in the white region and some constant in the dark region. And that dark region's volume hasn't changed, so our entropy is not increasing. It is not increasing unless you take your glasses off. If you take your glasses off, then the boundaries here will become blurred so that the black and the white merge. It begins looking gray. It looks like it's spread over a large region. And that is the cause of entropy rising. So the conclusion from this is that the exact entropy is conserved. It is only when there is some kind of blurring, what we call coarse graining, we are averaging over some kind of finite cell, there's a finite limit to the precision of our measurements. In that case, the entropy would increase. There's a slight caveat here in that we're assuming no kind of conspiracy in the initial conditions. This, I could have, for instance, evolved this backwards in time and found the same entropy rise. Now, in de Broglie-Bohm, it's not rho and d omega that are conserved, but the ratio of rho to the Born distribution. And we're not in phase space, obviously, because there's quantum mechanics. We're in configuration space. So not these two quantities, but those two quantities. Correspondingly, the entropy has a slight difference. And this means that the state of maximum entropy is not a uniform distribution as it would have been in classical mechanics, but mod psi squared. So if one accepts the standard arguments for entropy rising in classical mechanics, then really there's very little difference between that and a nice little proof to show you that mod psi squared is maximum entropy in standard quantum mechanics. Now, let's have a look at this happening. Now, could we perhaps turn the lights down here? Thank you. Okay, so what you're looking at is a harmonic oscillator, 2D harmonic oscillator here, superposition of the first few modes in each direction. And on this side, a load of system configurations. And I've distributed the system configurations as a two-dimensional Gaussian, just for want of a function to distribute them as. So the idea is that we'll let this go, and we'll do that by. And you should be able to see that over time, just as in the classical distribution I showed you before, fine structure starts emerging. And this fine structure over time should get finer and finer until the point at which you shouldn't be able to tell that it's that. So this result actually holds more generally, actually. It holds for any distribution that has particular configurations that follow a velocity field that conserves some other distribution. The first will end up tending towards the latter. So I think we're at the point now where we can basically not tell the difference between those two. Okay. So the idea is that if one's looking at de Broglie, then without this idea of non-equilibrium, de Broglie is experimentally indistinguishable from normal quantum mechanics, normal quantum theory. So really one of the most interesting questions we could ask as people who are studying this is, well, we kind of view, I guess, this relaxation process as the cause of quantum probabilities. And if they're the cause of quantum probabilities, then assumably at some point earlier in time, then there was a state of quantum non-equilibrium. And if there was, then could it still exist to this day in the statistics of something that is measurable? Now, there has been work on the statistics of the cosmic microwave background. I'm not going to talk about that now. I'm going to talk about something else. I've been working towards the idea that in some kind of relic particle species, then we might discover the statistics of quantum non-equilibrium. So here's a basic scenario to keep in mind throughout the talk. So in the very early universe, whatever cosmological model you're using, a particle species is created. That particle species, in order to preserve non-equilibrium, would have to become decoupled very, very early in the universe. After that, it would have to propagate freely. Any interaction could feasibly cause a significant amount of relaxation. But at some point, that particle could decay or annihilate. This would have to happen after recombination in order for the photons that would be produced to propagate freely thereafter. And so the idea is that these photons that are produced by the annihilation or the decay of these non-equilibrium particles could be detected by telescopes today. So what kind of particles are we talking about? Well, there's quite a few. There's a long, long list of these things. And of course, I didn't come up with these. These are motivated by several different reasons, primarily the search for dark matter. We still don't know what 85% roughly of the matter constituents of the universe is. There are other problems. There are other issues, the gauge hierarchy problem, the neutrino mass problem, strong CP. There's other motivations for these particles. But yes, they provide us with a long list of candidate species. For a brief outline, an illustrative scenario involving the Gravitino, we outlined that in a paper published late last year. Now, if one knew well about the properties of whichever of these turns out to ultimately be the dark matter, or whether or not, I don't know, there could be a larger dark sector, without knowing the properties of whichever particles are out there, it's very difficult to come up with any kind of estimation of the likelihood of non-equilibrium surviving to this day. So let's take a different track here. And instead of discussing which types of particles could display this non-equilibrium, let's talk about how this non-equilibrium could manifest in experiment today. Now, this outline along here is happening. This is hoped, well, in the absence of the non-equilibrium, it's hoped that we could discover dark matter through detection by telescopes and through its annihilation into photons. Of course, dark matter doesn't interact directly with the electromagnetic field, so these annihilations and decays will have to be loop suppressed. But it's long been argued that it's a good avenue for the discovery of dark matter. Particularly the annihilation would create two back-to-back photons with a mass of half of the with an energy of half the mass of the annihilating dark matter particles. So how do these telescopes involved in the indirect search for dark matter work? Well, I'm going to take the example of WIMPs. And WIMPs, if they did annihilate, would produce gamma photons. And so we're concerned with gamma telescopes here, of which YGRET, Fermi LAT, and this DAMP telescope that was launched, I think, December last year. So that's the most recent. There's two more. These are proposed to be launched in 2020, I believe. Now, the gamma ray night sky is so dim that photons arrive into the telescope one by one. And as such, the telescopes represent, they are more akin to particle physics experiments than standard astronomy. They are designed to measure the energy of each individual photon that enters them. These readings aren't perfect. They satisfy this thing here, which will become important, the energy dispersion probability distribution function. This is an example one taken from a Fermi collaboration paper. In general, these are dependent on other such things like angular variation, but we're going to take a simple situation here where we say that the energy dispersion probability distribution function, which is a mouthful, is only dependent on the true energy of the incident photon. This thing is most easily quantified by the energy dispersion, which is essentially just the spread, the standard deviation of the probability distribution function. Now, why is this important? Well, over an ensemble of readings, over a few years while these telescopes are out taking readings, then they will build up an observed spectrum. Now, that observed spectrum will be a convolution of the probability distribution function with the actual line spectrum, the true spectrum. And we can consider this equation in two regimes. Firstly, if the which way around have I got this? If the width of this is much smaller than the width of the spectral line that you are discovering, then we approximate the PDF to be a delta function, in which case your observed spectrum closely approximates the actual spectrum. That's almost like a perfect measurement. On the other hand, if the widths are the other way around, so that the actual line spectrum, the true spectrum, is much narrower than the energy dispersion, then the telescope isn't so much observing the line, rather than it's observing its own interaction with the photons. The line profile that would be observed closely approximates the energy dispersion of the telescope. This is a function of the telescope itself. Now, this is important because there is a concept in de Broglie-Bohm called no back reaction. This means that if these two dark matter particles annihilate, the quantum state will have a definite energy, And so because the energy is a function of the quantum state, not the configuration, then non-equilibrium doesn't change the energy of these photons. So that essentially, so that all of the conventional effects that alter the shape of spectral lines alter this thing itself, the actual energy of the incident photons. What non-equilibrium would do is alter this thing, the way or the statistics of how the telescope interact with the photon. And so in the first of these regimes, any effect of non-equilibrium will most likely be obscured by the conventional line effects. In the second regime, then the effects of non-equilibrium would presumably dominate. Now, this is important because, just to compare, I guess, with the experiment here. So the Fermi LHT has an energy dispersion of 10% of the, or roughly 10% of the energy of the incident photon. So, for instance, if a 100 gigaelectron volt photon came in, then you've got only a 68% chance of recording an energy between 90 and 110. Whereas for WIMP annihilation, we expect any intrinsic spread of the spectral lines there to be only about 0.1% of the energy. And that's mainly due to droplet broadening. So we are firmly in the second regime here, where the effects of non-equilibrium could dominate. Okay, so we're going to try and cook up a simple model to hopefully capture the essence of the physical behavior here. We're going to model a spectral measurement. And in order to model it, I'm going to quickly go through the standard de Broglie-Bohm theory of measurement due to Holland here. So the idea is that you couple the system to a pointer. It's a simple linear coupling. This G here is the coupling constant. We take that to be zero prior to the measurement and take it to be large thereafter. So we make it large enough so that it dominates the rest of the Schrodinger equation. We make it large enough so that the interaction Hamiltonian entirely governs the subsequent evolution of the system pointer system. Now, if we do that, we find this evolution here. So each component in this summation is translated in the direction of the pointer. And it does so at, well, I guess a speed here, this an, that is proportional to the is proportional to the eigenvalue of the operator that you're measuring. So initially, you could have some complicated superposition here. There's interference happening. This is the direction of the pointer. This is the direction of the system. It's a simple harmonic oscillator, just to illustrate. And we turn the measurement on. And in the direction of the pointer, each component in that summation separate. So that once they're separated, they can't interfere anymore. And the conclusion of the experiment would be to, well, an experimenter would know that the conclusion of the experiment is to find the pointer in the nth region with the nth eigenvalue at a probability of the amplitude modded and squared. So the discrete spectrum there would be constructed through repeated measurements over an ensemble. Now, important to note there that we, in de Broglie-Bohm, because there is definite configurations, every system will exist at a particular point on this graph. As such, there's no need for wave function collapse once the measurement has been concluded. We simply find the system in one point of the configuration space with one outcome of the experiment. No need for wave function collapse, no need for an observer, no non-unitary evolution. There is, however, an effective collapse as the points of the components of this that don't contain the system will no longer contribute to the dynamics of the part that does. Essentially, the only part of the wave function that is relevant after the experiment is the part that contained the system. So we're going to do that, and in order to hopefully capture the essence of the spectral measurement of these photons, we'll apply this, and the operator that we'll measure is the entire energy of the electromagnetic field. So we've put the Hamiltonian for the electromagnetic field in the place where the arbitrary operator went in before. We're going to treat the initial pointer as Gaussian because it's a sensible thing to do. It is box normalized. We can, I guess, pretend in this little toy model that the box that the field is normalized in represents the volume of the telescope. And we'll take it so that along, as with these gamma ray telescopes, there's only one photon in this box at any one time. And with actually quite trivial mathematics, you can show that you obtain this energy dispersion probability distribution function. Now, this is Gaussian. Now, before the energy dispersion was defined as the full width 68% containment window, this is Gaussian. So the energy dispersion is simply the standard deviation. Right. One of the nice things about this, though, is that the arbitrary parameters that we introduced at the beginning, the coupling constant, the sigma, y, that was the initial spread of the pointer. Now, they're quite difficult to interpret. The coupling constant in particular has units of inverse momentum. But in combination, their combination is simply the energy dispersion. It's the resolution of the telescope. So we can absorb all the free parameters there into the resolution of the telescope. They together determine that. So we have a model that's completely parameter free. And you note that I have absorbed the time in here, the duration of the experiment. That means, in a sense, the longer the experiment runs for, the better the telescope that we are modeling. And as such, with this new definition of time, we can model these different telescopes, or the resolution of these different telescopes, at these different final times. Okay. So the extension of this model to de Broglie-Bohm, the derivation of the velocity fields, is rather tedious and long. It's the kind of thing where you'd sit down with a pen and a pad of paper and finish in a couple of days. But it's fairly prosaic. So we're going to skip that and have a look at how the system actually behaves. So what you're looking at here is the configuration. You have the pointer coordinate here. Now, I've rescaled that and shifted it. It is now measured in standard deviations of the initial pointer packet. And it is done such that a perfect reading is exactly in the middle there. The horizontal axis is a field coordinate corresponding to the mode of the photon, the mode of the field that was excited that corresponds to the photon. The green here is the Born distribution. It's a double bump because essentially it's a harmonic oscillator that has a first excited state. On top of that, I've placed, I believe it's 10,000 trajectories, 10,000 system configurations. And I've done so such that the width of those is 3 times the width of the Born distribution. On this side, we have a spectral line, and we're measuring it in units of this energy dispersion. So the green line here is exactly what you would get in equilibrium. The yellow bars, the histogram, is the non-equilibrium. So, and before I start this running, time and resolution are reciprocal. And since time is zero, we all know what the reciprocal of zero is. There's a lot of stars there. That'll change. That's just initially the experiment hasn't begun, so we haven't got a reading yet. So let's have a look at it running. So the fine structure starts evolving here. There's lots of different types of phenomena you can observe in here. I'm going to stop and rewind and show you different points in this.
Are we seeing non-equilibrium?
So this is the non-equilibrium evolving.
Okay. It's the difference between the green and the yellow.
Yes. The green is the equilibrium. The yellow is the non-equilibrium. So there's no proxy for energy here. This is, I guess, the spectral line that you would, the telescope would observe. A perfect reading is in the middle there. So this is for an arbitrary energy, for any energy. And a perfect reading is at zero. We expect the green Gaussian spectral line from equilibrium.
Let me ask my question a different way then. So what you get out of the experiment is a particular Y value in any given run. And then can you remind me how I go from the distribution of such Y values that I get at a given time to the histogram of energy?
Yeah. So essentially, you would assume, I guess the real reason behind this is in the bit that I skipped. But yeah, you'd assume that the initial pointer was a delta function. You get rid of all of the quantum uncertainty in the initial pointer, and so that in that case, there's actually an isomorphism from the energy of the photon to the position of the pointer. So if it's isomorphic, you can invert it. And so we do that, and you end up getting values that correspond to this this distribution, which is plotted in green here. So let's have a look one more time at that. This is a widened distribution. Oops. So I'm going to stop it at that. So this is a 20%. You note that this is wider, and it's shifted. So there's two possibilities. This is actually very much significantly wider than you would get from the 0.1% intrinsic broadening that we discussed before. Then what tends to happen is, as this fine structure starts to evolve, as the distribution gets swirled up, you form shelves and structures in the line. So the initial non-equilibrium here is somewhat arbitrary. We don't really have any sense of what initial non-equilibrium we should really be putting into these things. So I've just parameterized it so that it's either wider or narrower by a certain factor. So that was the wider version. The narrower version is here. You notice that the Born distribution is much bigger in this picture. I've zoomed in here. And so this is a quarter of the width. So we're starting the field coordinate at a quarter. Oops. So do you note now that I'm stopping it at 20%, the same place as it was before? And we have this spectacular, strong line. Now, that line is narrower than the telescope should conventionally be able to resolve. So there's nothing that could really cause that apart from low statistics or some kind of systematic error. There's no conventional physical reason for that. I'll let it continue. So we've got a double bump. So we're kind of approaching the limit of contemporary experimental resolution here. You note that this is actually fairly similar to the Born distribution. So that actually, if this were indeed the case, and that is a highly speculative statement, very arguable, but if it were representing what is truly happening in experiment, then actually lower resolution telescopes here would be better at distinguishing non-equilibrium. So that early on in the evolution, before much relaxation has taken place, so for instance, so your EGRET telescope is about here. Your Fermi LAT is about here. You notice the two very strong double bumps. Again, separated by a distance that is smaller than the telescope should be able to resolve. So, yeah. But if you let it continue, then you more and more closely approximate this non-equilibrium. Okay. So some brief conclusions here, and then I'll open to more questions. So So to try and emphasize the difference between the effects here and conventional physical effects that alter the shape of spectral lines, the most important thing, in my opinion, is this distinction between length scales. So for instance, these two graphs that are taken from the first animation that I showed you are both widened. But one needs to bear in mind that this is 20% energy dispersion. This is 0.1%. So this is 200 times wider than that one. This could easily be confused with conventional line broadening. This one is 200 times larger than the length scale we were talking about before. So that's quite a significant effect. One little corollary of that is that the non-equilibrium would be more easily detected, would be more prominent in lower resolution telescopes. Second conclusion. So there is a possibility for spectral line narrowing. Now that didn't really make sense in standard terminology, because when somebody talks about line broadening and line narrowing, what they're talking about is the shape and alteration of the actual physical spectrum, not the observed spectrum. Here we're altering the observed spectrum. So there is a possibility for narrowing that, as far as I'm aware, couldn't be caused by other physical effects. There's also these double bumps and features that happen on this scale that's too small to resolve. This is a point that surely it would harm the chances of any consensus over a discovery. The fact that two telescopes will most likely discover different profiles. Now that, as scientists, we like the idea of reproducibility, of replication, but if that's not possible, at least in the conventional standard sense, then this may cause problems. So I'm going to stop and just take a step back and say that, look, this is a very, very simple model. But the arguments on the length scales is a general argument that wasn't dependent on the model. It is likely that even if two telescopes had the same resolution, because the inner workings are different, then they produce different distributions. It is even perceivable that, you know, these telescopes are very complicated in their workings. Like the LAT, for instance, is a pair conversion telescope. The photons come in, there's an anti-coincidence layer, the photon gets converted into a positron and an electron. The positron and the electron interact in a very complicated way with the telescope. Many, many interactions, all of which, if one were to try to quantify, if one were to try to look into how non-equilibrium would behave in those interactions, well, those interactions would have to be dealt with on a field theory basis. And interactions in field theory are inevitably dealt with in terms of perturbation theory. And perturbative methods really don't help in de Broglie-Bohm. We need a full solution to the Schrödinger equation. So the model has necessarily had to be very, very simple. It's very, very possible that telescopes are complicated enough to even allow full relaxation, even during the process of measurement. So it's highly debatable, all of this. But I think some interesting effects. So I'll finish off with some quotes from the literature. For those of you who are not aware, in, I think it's 2012, there was a large controversy over a 130 giga electron volt line that had been thought to be detected in the data from the LAT. We now think that was just some systematic error. But at the time, some of the discussion in the literature was interesting. There was a large flurry of papers. Initially, there was some thoughts that it wasn't one line, but two. The thought being that one of the lines could be an annihilation and the other one a decay. The Fermi team argued, and this is quoted from the US Department of Energy, who fund a lot of this science. The Fermi team argued that the line profile was about 2 to 3 times too narrow. Again, kind of consistent with the results that we were getting. The narrowness is actually the lines that we showed before that were narrow. That actually happens for a large range of different types of initial non-equilibrium. So that's a kind of general feature that we might assume to see. There are many different types of studies looking for these lines. In general, what happens is that they have a number of data points. They have a null hypothesis and an alternative hypothesis. They fit the data to the two hypotheses and compare the two. Now, the alternative hypothesis assumes that you would observe that standard spectral width, so that any broadening or narrowing would just count against the significance of a result, lower the sigma value. This final quote here is on from a study where they were looking at, it was called a stacked investigation of many different galaxies. And so they compose a spectrum for many different galaxies and have a look to see whether the spectral lines in the data there, the idea being that you have a much larger data set. They found different results from different galaxies, though. They studied some subsamples and found different results from different subsamples. And I guess I want to highlight the fact that non-equilibrium would almost be the distribution that you would observe. And there's no reason, per se, to think that two different galaxies should contain the same non-equilibrium. So, again, this may harm the chances of any reproducibility. Anyway, okay. So, I know that was very quick. Thank you for listening. Yes.
I'm trying to understand how your model is expected to map onto the actual gamma ray telescopes. In particular, you should have modeled where you're looking at the energy profile you see as a function of the amount of time that's passed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it doesn't have a kind of evolving state. So at the end of the day, you get an estimate of what all the energy that came in was.
Mm-hmm.
So is the idea that you imagine that your idealized model will capture sort of the basic physics of a given gamma ray telescope at some, you know, corresponding to some particular time of interaction?
So yeah, there was a few constants there that, in a sense, there is time involved. This is a dynamical process. But the time variable in this model never appeared apart from the coupling constant, for instance. And the coupling constant is difficult to interpret. So that it's easier just to take all of those variables that were hard to interpret, and actually just a simple combination of all of them was the resolution of the measurement. And so why not interpret in terms of those, in terms of that instead? That's easier, in my opinion, anyway.
The idea is that if I tell you the energy resolution of my gamma ray telescope, you interpret that as some fraction of the total equilibration time, and then you look to your results to figure out what kinds of effects you might expect to see, whether it's decreasing the line width or broadening the line width.
So the model is only meant to display the kinds of characteristics that one might see. I'm certainly not arguing that this is mimicking these telescopes in any way, but it ultimately describes a process that the ultimate conclusion to this model is what the telescope is designed to do. So in a way, the telescope is designed to mimic the model rather than the other way around. They're terribly complicated. Modeling a full-scale telescope would just not be physically, it wouldn't be reasonable. But we hope to capture at least some of the physics and highlight the kinds of phenomena we might see.
Maybe the thing that would resolve my own confusion is if you could rewind to the bit where, for the idealized model of a von Neumann coupling, can you repeat what the time of interaction, and the energy resolution are? I think if I understood it there.
So yeah, they are reciprocal to each other.
So
the longer we let the
So maybe what is capital T?
Capital T is just a rescaling of the time. Was the true time, the original time we introduced.
And so I should think of little t as the size of the interval of time during which this photonic field has interacted with my pointer?
Yeah, it's the duration of the experiment. But we can regard it as a dynamical variable as well as the full duration. So that every single frame in those animations on the next slide represented the results of a certain telescope of a certain resolution.
So a different telescope corresponds to a different small field?
Yes. Yes, indeed. Yeah. So, yeah, the duration, the big T of the experiment is reciprocal to the resolution of the telescope that you're attempting to model.
Ways I could have a really sort of bad energy dispersion. You know, one, a very short time of interaction that presumably would give me, according to this relation, a lot of dispersion. But maybe also I just have a really bad telescope that's extremely noisy.
Yeah.
So maybe the correct interpretation of my telescope is actually it's been interacting and there's lots of time for equilibration to occur. And looking at the energy dispersion doesn't give me a good proxy to the time of interaction.
Oh, I mean, you could think to try to divide the cause of the... So there was a lot of effort put into calculating these energy dispersion probability distribution functions. And you can I guess, try to divide how much of the spread of this thing is due to a quantum effect and how much is due to classical effects. How much of this is due to simple kind of systematic error, and how much of it is due to a kind of fundamental physical limit in the quantum mechanics that you assume. Now, I haven't done that. But yes, certainly, if you could certainly argue that most of that, or at least part of that, was due to a classical effect. And we could build that into the model here and come up with a more sophisticated model, but I guess I was starting at the start and trying to cook up the simplest possible model. Yeah, so the way they come up with these things is to is through Monte Carlo simulations. They run photons through a computational model of the telescope, and these photons have definite position, but they have a probability of decaying depending in which medium they are in within the telescope. That probability, however, is presumably has a quantum origin. So there is certainly part of that is due to a quantum effect, but presumably also part of it is due to a classical effect.
Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, even if you sort of built your sort of dream telescope that like really did closely fit this kind of model, mm-hmm. right? So like completely different to the sort of actual complication.
So that's half of what I've been thinking to do, right? Rather than just trying to model physical telescopes that are out there today, rather actually design a telescope that would be good at distinguishing non-equilibrium. But sorry, continue.
Yeah, so my question is, supposing you did that, there would still be a lot of interactions and physical systems involved sort of before anyone actually gets to see the results, right? Like, say, your telescope's going to be hooked up to a computer, and then, I don't know, the results appear on the computer screen, someone writes them down in a book, they give the book to you, all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of don't have a good enough intuition of this non-equilibrium only mechanics to know whether equilibration could happen during all of that rather than...
So this is easier to discuss with a discrete spectrum rather than a continuous spectrum. So in this case, we were discussing a discrete spectrum. So the idea is that the different components of the spectrum separate in configuration space. Now, the pointer, you could think of the pointer as an abstract concept, or you could think of it as a physical pointer. Now, if one was to observe the pointer, then one would have to introduce another pointer to observe the original pointer. Now, that would be another dimension in the configuration space. So that actually what would happen then is that these three components move in a separate direction. They don't recombine and overlap in any way. They don't interfere with each other in any way. Once the experiment is concluded, we presume that those different components shouldn't interact anymore. So I guess that's the discrete case. The continuum case would be kind of analog of that. So that I guess there could be an opportunity for close energies to interfere again, but beyond some beyond some physical energy scale, then there definitely would not be any further interference.
So saying that there isn't further interference, that means that like there's things that are zero in the wave function, right, or approximately zero in the wave function, like certain overlaps of approximately zero.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not assuming quantum equilibrium, like does that still actually tell you that you don't have to worry about what's going to happen?
I'm not sure I understand.
Right, like the fact that the wave function says that the point of reading behaves approximately classically during its further interactions, is that actually enough to say that this like non-equilibrium position will also behave in the expected way?
So the non-equilibrium would have, if there were non-equilibrium here, now I guess in equilibrium each component here has would have an equal number of actual systems in an ensemble. Each component would have an equal number, an equal probability of having the system in it. The amplitudes are all one over root three. Non-equilibrium would affect this so that the probability is not equal for each one of these. More of the systems in a particular ensemble would be, say, in the first region of the space rather than the second. It's not every component has a third anymore. One might have a half. Now, if half of your systems are in that component, and that component no longer interacts with the other components, then all of a sudden, yeah, the non-equilibrium would be preserved then. So in the paper I highlighted, I gave some actual numerical calculations of a process like that in the context of the measurement, energy measurement of a field mode rather than the full field. And so the non-equilibrium there would affect the spectrum that you observe. The actual spectrum is, of course, defined by the amplitudes. Have I gone away to answering the question, though?
I think so. Is there a very general statement that equilibration doesn't happen if you have sort of pseudo-classical?
I'm not aware of one, but it would be an interesting avenue to go down, I think.
Well, I think you can, the fact that you end up treating the system by an effective wave function.
Yeah.
So the subsequent, so when you have interaction with a relatively macroscopic pointer, you end up, your particle is one of the terms corresponding to different values of the pointer. So you have entanglement between your system and your pointer state. And then your configuration is in one of those terms. So then when you calculate the velocity using the guidance formula, Rad-S thing, it only depends on where the particle is. It doesn't care about the other terms. And so any non-equilibrium will stop there. You have to stay there.
So the other components are sometimes called empty packets or empty waves.
Yeah.
And so the idea is, because they just get separated from the part of the wave function that contains the system and no longer interact.
So you couldn't get re-interaction between those two parts.
I still think that there's a concern here, but it doesn't have anything to do, I agree, with the interactions between the different terms. So my understanding of whether you expect non-equilibrium distribution to evolve to an equilibrium distribution on a short time scale or not has to do with the nature, for example, of the potential well. So if I look at the Bohmian guidance equation, it's very, you know, integrable evolution, then I, you know, there's not going to be a lot of chaotic motion. It's going to stay in non-equilibrium essentially forever. Like, you know, an S-wave orbital, if I prepare, you know, an electron who's prepared in the S-wave wave function in some non-equilibrium distribution, well, there the Bohmian dynamics is trivial, so it's going to stay in non-equilibrium. But if I put in a wedge potential where the classical dynamics is chaotic, then I expect, much like all these studies, some of which you showed, that's going to equilibrate quickly. So even
for potentials that would have a very simple classical behavior. So for instance, the potential that I discussed at the very beginning, now this, I had to pick a nasty polynomial there. If I'd picked a harmonic oscillator, then there wouldn't have been any classical relaxation at all. But in the de Broglie-Bohm dynamics for a standard harmonic oscillator, even for just a simple small superposition of the first few modes, then yeah, you get quite efficient relaxation. So energy states tend not to relax trivially, but any small superposition, any kind of small interaction, would inevitably lead to relaxation. Now this hasn't been heavily studied. There's still lots of unknowns here. What has tended to be studied is two-dimensional systems with simple potentials. We don't really know how non-equilibrium would act for a higher dimensional system, for instance. So there's open questions here. But yeah, even for simple classical potentials, you can get quite efficient relaxation.
Fine. But so let me still express the concern. So I grant that the division between, you know, will relax efficiently and will not relax efficiently isn't simply, you know, has chaotic classical dynamics or not, it's something else. But there certainly are systems that won't relax, like the energy eigenstates. Mm-hmm. And there are certainly systems that'll, you know, relax very quickly, like the chaotic dynamics, and then there's this region in between. But to some extent, this whole thing relies on the idea that, you know, if some non-equilibrium resource in the early universe could get locked in by virtue of being encoded in degrees of freedom that are of that special type that don't relax. Mm-hmm. Right? So you know, you got these photons coming from the early universe, and you're assuming, okay, there the non-equilibrium is locked in. But I think the concern then is that if you're reading them out in your apparatus, and you're not careful to sort of make sure that you lock in the outcome of your experiment into a degree of freedom that does not relax quickly, then, you know, when you come after your coffee break and the, you know, experiment's over, oh, the length of your coffee break is such that, you know, the dynamics of your experimental degrees of freedom has caused relaxation,
sure.
Which I take to be the spirit of Matt's question. So to what extent can you say that, you know, once you've kind of locked in the outcome of your experiment, you've now re-encoded that non-equilibrium or that evidence of non-equilibrium in degrees of freedom that aren't going to evolve to just the plain old quantum probabilities that we expect?
So I think the answer to that is that you reinterpret. There's a wave. So in standard quantum mechanics, there would be what is termed a wave function collapse here.
Yep.
And that is the thing that hard encodes
let me fine tune my. So I'm happy to say, yeah, there's an effective wave function corresponding to the particular outcome you got.
Mm-hmm.
But now the question is, look at the evolution of that wave function. What guarantees do you have that it is not causing relaxation, right? So I'm not worried about the other terms. I'm worried about that, just that one term. And my concern is that once you look at the particular effective wave function associated with a particular pointer reading, you've got a system in hand which causes relaxation very quickly. And therefore, you're not gonna see non-equilibrium just because of the nature of that dynamics in your apparatus. Like, that's the concern.
So I'm trying to hone in on this point as well. No. So once these are separated, there is no physical way for the system to get from one component to the other.
Again, so not my concern. So let me just clarify, because okay. I want to make sure we're talking about the same issue. Take one of those peaks. I grant it's the effective wave function now.
Mm-hmm.
But imagine a sprinkling of Bohmian positions whose distribution does not correspond to that peak. Okay, so you've induced a non-equilibrium distribution in your pointer.
Mm-hmm.
There's no guarantee that that'll stay non-equilibrium. So it's sort of like, it seems to me the evolution of that single peak is relevant for how long I can expect.
So there's this idea of effective collapse. Once you've found the pointer in one, then the other components of the wave function no longer contribute to the dynamics. And so effectively, you now only have that part of the wave function. But you have only that part of the wave function, and you have that at a different probability to what you would usually have.
So you're sort of like binning it up into some bins, and then you imagine that the bins.
So,
like, your answer is not going to change over time because the probability that you got it in this bin is.
Yeah, it's we'd say it's collapsed. So the non-equilibrium affects the amount of systems in an ensemble that you would find in each branch. But once the measurement has taken place, all you have is that branch now, and the dynamics would continue. Essentially, the act of measurement and the act of this effective collapse relaxes the system in to an extent. Now, like, if we consider the system now to have a wave function that is only that component, then the effect of non-equilibrium is to affect how much of it collapses into this, how much of it collapses into that, but afterwards, then effectively you've got a standard quantum mechanical system again, an equilibrium system. It's just which system that the non-equilibrium would affect. Is that helping?
Yeah, that helps a lot. So if I understand correctly, then it is possible to kind of lock in classical records of non-equilibrium phenomena. Like once you've amplified it, you've got a probability distribution that's indicative of non-equilibrium phenomena, then that's preserved in the world. So that means that a totally different way of trying to find evidence for non-equilibrium would be to try to imagine ways in which in the early universe non-equilibrium distributions might get locked into classical degrees of freedom, which could then survive to this day. And then we can sort of look at those classical degrees of freedom and say, well, according to my model of the universe, these degrees of freedom should be recording the energy distribution of some quantum systems, and hey, they're not what they're supposed to be, so...
Sure, yeah, so...
We don't need that non-equilibrium to actually last to today, we just need the classical records of it to last to today.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. It's a very interesting idea. One imagines that you could observe maybe relative populations of species created very early, and maybe the populations are out of sync. A lot of these particles are presumed to be created in a... So for instance, WIMPs. One of the prime motivations of WIMPs is that they reproduce the correct relic density to be all the dark matter we see. And they do that because if you have a particle species that interacts through the weak interaction and has a particular mass, then as the hot Big Bang evolves, the particle species gets frozen out at a certain period, and it gets frozen out with the correct relic density. Now, if there was non-equilibrium, then maybe that could affect the relic density of certain particles. But I guess that is a hot Big Bang, in which case thermal equilibrium, in which case we expect very efficient relaxation. So I guess effects like the ones you're talking about would have to take place presumably in the early stages of pre or reheating before any relaxation could take place. But this is a highly dimensional system. It's the universe. So we have very little idea of how non-equilibrium behaves in highly dimensional systems. So yeah, it's a completely open question.
But then does the ratio of matter to antimatter get fixed?
Perhaps.
Sorry, I don't know.
Ratio of
does it get fixed very early on, or?
I'm not sure. I wouldn't. It's not my area of expertise. Certainly, one of the initial motivations of why we don't see magnetic monopoles, inflation, I believe, was initially. That was one of the initial motivations for inflation. So maybe it could affect that. Maybe it could affect matter, antimatter, moments. It's, I guess there's quite a few different things, but it goes back to the arguments I was trying to make here. Any estimate of where we could discover non-equilibrium would be heavily dependent on whichever cosmological model you assume and whichever particle physics model, whichever extension to the standard model that you assume. Both of these areas are very highly speculative, some of the most unsure parts of contemporary physics. So my idea with the spectral lines was that, well, maybe that's a simpler question we could hope to begin to answer.
Based on what you said here, is it right that opportunities to test these sorts of ideas would rely on having detected dark matter through gamma rays? So we would first say, oh no, we sort of know what dark matter is, these kind of particles. But there's this anomaly in what we're seeing.
Yeah.
Now let's interpret that as quantum equilibrium.
So likely, yes. So for instance, with the current generation of telescopes, there's very low statistics involved. You're talking about sample sizes in the hundreds or in the thousands. And when they try to fit the alternative hypothesis with the spectral line to the data to that, then they come up with a number for the amount of spectral, the number of photons that were signal photons, and it tends to be only in the tens or low hundreds, in which case these distributions that I was showing you before would be indistinguishable from the background, I think. So these distributions were 10,000. If they could get 10,000 signal photons in an LIT experiment, they'd be rather pleased with themselves, I think. It's likely that if this were indeed an effect that could be observed, then we'd probably observe it post detection of the line in the first place.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.